Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Technology Report and This is America, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. Today on the program, we will report on efforts to save 20th century recordings of black gospel music.
We have 8,000 plus individual sides digitized and cataloged, and more coming in every day.
Efforts to save 20th century gospel music. Today on As It Is. America's Smithsonian Institution has announced plans to add some rare music recordings to a new museum in Washington, D.C. For the past few years, the recordings have been stored at Baylor University in Texas. The collection is known as the Black Gospel Music Restoration Project. Bob Darden is now a college professor in Waco, Texas. But in 1960, he was a small child whose father had just brought home the family's first long-playing phonograph records. Two of the record albums did not interest the boy, but the other one was different.
The third was Mahalia Jackson's Christmas album. And my parents say, about age six or so, that I played Mahalia's album over and over.
A thrill of the weary world rejoices, for yonder great, a new and glorious morn.
Bob Darden's interest in that kind of music never went away. When he grew up, he became gospel music editor for Billboard magazine. As years passed, he found it harder and harder to find the music he loved. In 2005, Bob Darden wrote a letter to the New York Times newspaper. He expressed concern that gospel music was disappearing. He says a man named Charles Royce read the letter.
And called that day and said, "Tell me what we need to do and I'll help fund it."
Charles Royce's gift was used to create the Black Gospel Music Restoration Project at Baylor, where Bob Darden taught. The music collection has grown.
We have 8,000 plus individual sides digitized and cataloged, and more coming in every day.
That is 8,000 mostly 45 RPM gospel records. The vinyl discs date from the 1940s to the 1970s. In 2011, the wife of former President George W. Bush learned of the collection. Laura Bush has a home in Waco. She serves on the Cultural Council of the Smithsonian Institution's new Museum of African American History and Culture. Dwendolyn Reese is the museum's curator of music and performing arts.
They let us know of this wonderful project that was going on in Texas, and then a team of people came up to show us the project and what they've accomplished, and we were all very impressed.
The 45 RPM gospel records were especially important. They often had a hit or popular song, on one side. Bob Darden describes the other side.
Usually where the artist does their own personal song.
He says many of the second side recordings were civil rights songs that few people knew about. He says that makes the records important historical objects.
No one will ask me what color you are, so barren though, segregation.
Historian Dwandalyn Reese says this was a surprise.
When one level you think people are just talking about religion, and the other side, they have a message embedded in that as well. The whole idea of being a civil rights movement message in a gospel record, which just totally blew my mind.
Bob Darden says African-American gospel music was the basis for most American music in the 20th century.
Every rock and roll African-American artist, every rap, every soul artist came out of the church and sang these songs.
Now, parts of this collection are on the way to Washington. Dwandalyn Reese says it is an important gift to the United States and the world. She says the Museum of African-American History and Culture will make the music available for more people.
Gives a forum for more people to hear this music and have access to it. I see this as an untold story that hasn't gotten its due yet.
The new museum is set to open in 2015.
That's why you like Roosevelt. That's why you like Roosevelt. Tell me why you like Roosevelt. Tell me why you like Roosevelt. Tell me why you like Roosevelt.
We would like to know what you want to hear about on a future show. We read every message you send us. Write to us at VOA Learning English, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or send an email to learningenglish@voanews.com. I'm Christopher Cruz. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week with more news about American music on The Voice of America.
Here's a freedom song for all your freedom fighters out there everywhere. And when you sing, remember the wonderful ones who lost their dedicated lives for this precious purpose and won't be around to see it through. Now sing, sing, every one of you.
Well, sometime I wonder,
is there freedom in this world?
Sometime I wonder,
is there freedom in this world?
Sometime I wonder,
is there freedom in this world?
Tell me where
is freedom?
The Technology Report is next, followed by This is America. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Technology Report. May 1st marked the 50th anniversary of a special computer language. The new code was designed to permit college students not trained in mathematics to use computers. 50 years ago, computer owners were mainly governments, businesses, and universities. Programmers wrote pages of commands in mathematical expressions to operate these early computers. John Kimeny and Thomas Kurtz were two professors in the mathematics department at Dartmouth College. They wanted students in other departments to be able to use their school's computer. So they developed a simpler set of computer commands called Beginner's All-Purpose Symbolic Instruction Code, or BASIC.
We deliberately invented a language that was almost devoid of many of the technical details that are present in other languages.
BASIC puts English commands such as if-then or go-to into a numerical language computers can understand. Mr. Kurtz says almost everyone at Dartmouth College began using computers.
Not only did our students love getting onto the computer and anytime they wanted to and for whatever purpose they wanted to, but even the faculty got interested. Of course, not everybody, but many of them.
BASIC was a major step toward the development of personal computers. Peggy Kidwell is the curator of mathematics at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. She says BASIC was created just as computers became fast enough to perform many commands at the same time.
Now, that whole notion that anybody could run a computer permeates the whole world. And I would say that that is not the immediate legacy of BASIC, but it is part of what was involved in building up on BASIC.
Mr. Kurtz and Mr. Kimeny released BASIC to the public for free. The computer language quickly became very popular. Mr. Kurtz says they hoped the language would solve what they saw as a major upcoming problem. Mr. Kurtz says he and Mr. Kimeny believed that the computer would become very important in the world. He says most people didn't know anything about computers because they were only used by experts. The speedy development of computers was followed by many improved versions of BASIC. Over the years, code writers created other easy-to-use computer languages. Today, few people use BASIC. But personal computers owe their existence to the first programming language that anyone could speak. And that's the VOA Learning English Technology Report. For more technology stories, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Jonathan Evans.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to This is America. I'm Steve Ember. Baseball is a sport that began in the eastern United States in the 1800s. It became known as the national pastime, a game that millions of people continue to enjoy each spring and summer. Major League Baseball recently opened its new season, so this is a good time to explore the influence of baseball on popular culture, including music and poetry. Many songs and poems have been written about baseball, and today, Shirley Griffith and I will tell you about some of them. Baseball expert Warner Fusel writes that there are probably more than 1,000 songs about baseball. The most popular is "Take Me Out to the Ball Game." It was written in 1908 by Jack Norworth. He wrote it after seeing a sign about baseball in an underground train in New York City. His friend, Albert von Tilzer, put the words to music. Mr. Norworth reportedly had never seen a Major League Baseball game. He did not see one until 33 years after he wrote the song.
People still sing "Take Me Out to the Ball Game" during baseball games.
Time for the stretch. For the ball game, please welcome John Michael Diaz, Brian McElroy, Michael Ingersoll, and James Speck, Chicago's own Jersey Boys.
All right, fans, let me hear ya.
Near the end of the game, people become tired of sitting on the hard seats. So during a special time in the game, everyone stands up and stretches their arms and legs. This tradition is called the seventh inning stretch. Everyone sings a song together. Most often it is "Take Me Out to the Ball Game." Here it is sung by the National Pastime Orchestra and singers.
Nellie Kelly loved baseball games, knew the players, knew all their names. You could see her there every day, shout hooray when they'd play. Her boyfriend by the name of Joe said, "Bucconi, I'll dear, let's go." Then Nellie started to fret and pout, and to him I heard a shout.
Baseball expert Richard Miller writes that many songs about other subjects, such as love, use words and expressions from baseball. For example, in a song written in 1912, a woman tells her boyfriend that she will not like him unless he is a good baseball player. The song is called "If You Can't Make a Hit in a Ball Game, You Can't Make a Hit with Me."
In 1943, George Moriarty wrote a song designed to support American forces fighting in World War II. Mr. Moriarty was a former baseball player and manager for the Detroit Tigers team. His song is called "You're Gonna Win That Ball Game, Uncle Sam." It is performed here by the National Pastime Orchestra and singers.
Uncle Sam, when you play ball, the rules must all be fair. Your name is in a golden frame for playing on the square. Uncle Sam, we've made a vow since that Pearl Harbor raid, and now it's up to you to show them how the game is played. You're gonna win that ball game, Uncle Sam. So pitch that cannonball the way you can. You are slow beginning, but just wait till that ninth inning. You can finish what they all began. Your team is all behind you to a man. So take your bat and make that home run slam. Keep the bases loaded till your hits have all exploded. You're gonna win that ball game, Uncle Sam.
Many songs have been written about America's baseball teams. These include the Brooklyn Dodgers, later the Los Angeles Dodgers, the Philadelphia Phillies, and the Chicago Cubs. Other songs have been written about famous baseball players, Babe Ruth, Jackie Robinson, and Joe DiMaggio.
Hello, Joe. What do you know?
We need a hit, so here I go.
Some people think Joe DiMaggio was the greatest player in the history of baseball. He hit safely in a record 56 games in a row for the New York Yankees in 1941. This record never has been broken. That same year, Les Brown and his band recorded the song Joltin' Joe DiMaggio. Betty Bonney sings about the way DiMaggio hit the ball very, very hard, how he jolted it.
All aglow. He's just a man and not a freak. Joltin' Joe DiMaggio.
Joe, Joe DiMaggio, we want you on our side.
He tied the mark at 44, July the 1st, you know. Since then he's hit a good 12 more. Joltin' Joe DiMaggio.
Joe, Joe DiMaggio, we want you on our side.
From coast to coast, that's all you'll hear of Joe, the one-man show. He's glorified the horse-hide sphere, Joltin' Joe DiMaggio.
Joe, Joe DiMaggio.
In 1955, a popular musical play about baseball opened on Broadway in New York. It was called Damn Yankees. It was about a middle-aged man who gets a chance to play baseball for his team, the Washington Senators. He plays against the best team in baseball, the New York Yankees. The Senators are not a very good team. Their manager wants them to play better. He urges them to play with all the feeling that is in their hearts. Here the cast of Damn Yankees sings, You Gotta Have Heart.
You gotta have a heart. All you really need is heart. When the odds are saying you'll never win, that's when the grin should start. You gotta have hope. Mustn't sit around and mope. Nothing's half as bad as it may appear. Wait till next year and hope. When your luck is batting zero, get your chin up off the floor. Mister, you can be a hero. You can open any door. There's nothing to it but to do it. You gotta.
In addition to the many songs written about baseball, there is a famous poem about the game, too. It is called Casey at the Bat. A young man named Ernest Thayer wrote the poem in 1888. It was published in the San Francisco Examiner newspaper. The poem still is popular today. Casey at the Bat is about a baseball team from a town called Mudville. The team is losing an important game. The game is almost over. Mudville is depending on its best player, Casey, to win the game.
The outlook wasn't brilliant for the Mudville Nine that day. The score stood 4-2 with but one inning more to play. And then when Cooney died at first and Barrows did the same, a sickly silence fell upon the patrons of the game. A straggling few got up to go in deep despair. The rest clung to that hope which springs eternal in the human breast. They thought if only Casey could but get a whack at that, we'd put even money now with Casey at the bat.
To the surprise of the crowd, two players hit the ball well. They reach second and third base. They are ready to score. Then it is Casey's turn at bat. He can win the game if he hits the ball hard enough so that he and the other players can cross home plate. That will give their team more points than their opponent.
There was an ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing and a smile on Casey's face. And when responding to the cheers, he lightly doffed his hat. No stranger in the crowd could doubt 'twas Casey at the bat. 10,000 eyes were on him as he rubbed his hands with dirt. 5,000 tongues applauded when he wiped them on his shirt. Then while the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance gleamed in Casey's eye. A sneer curled Casey's lip.
The opposing pitcher throws the ball, but Casey does not try to hit it. The pitcher throws the ball again. Again, Casey does not try to hit it. There are now two strikes against him. One more strike, and he will be out. The game will be over. Will Casey finally hit the ball? Will he win the game? The crowd is sure he will.
The sneer is gone from Casey's lip. His teeth are clenched in hate. He pounds with cruel violence his bat upon the plate. And now the pitcher holds the ball, and now he lets it go, and now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow. Oh, somewhere in this favored land, the sun is shining bright. The band is playing somewhere, and somewhere hearts are light. And somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout. But there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out.
Heaney Majeski, Johnny G, Eddie Juiced, Johnny Pesky, Thornton Lee, Danny Gardella, Van Lingle Munglo.
Dave Frischberg is a songwriter and jazz pianist, and he loves baseball. In fact, he wrote a song in which the words are nothing but the names of famous and perhaps some not-so-famous baseball players. Van Lingle Mungo is the name of the song.
Augie Bergamo, Sigmund Jacoki, Big Johnny Mize and Barney McCoskey, Hal Trosky, Gullan and Pinky May, Stan Hack and Frenchie Bordagaray, Phil Cavaretta, George McQuinn, Howard Pollett and Early Wynn, Roy Campanella, Van Lingle Mungo.
Our program was written by Shelley Gullist. Jim Tedder read portions of the poem Casey at the Bat. I'm Steve Ember. Join us again next week for another This Is America from VOA Learning English.
Big Johnny Mize and Barney McCoskey, Hal Trosky.